Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, important new al-Qaeda arrests in Europe that could help build the case for a terror link to Saddam Hussein's Iraq. While in Iraq, the president thrills the troops, but should the press be lied to? And this Thanksgiving weekend, a glimpse of who the homeless really are. And which states are good and which are lousy for your health.
I think it's probably not so much urban versus rural as much as it is whether or not a state is involved in the comprehensive things that need to be done.
These stories and the pleasures and perils of making a movie that's awfully close to your own life story. Irish director Jim Sheridan on his new film, In America, coming up Here and Now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The holiday shopping season is off to a frenzied start. Bargain hunters were up before dawn today to take advantage of early bird specials. NPR's Kathleen Schalk reports.
In Marietta, Georgia, the line outside the Walmart store began forming Thursday night by 9. When the doors opened at 6 o'clock this morning, some shoppers lost shoes in the stampede. People showed up by 3 a.m. outside a Best Buy in Coralville, Iowa, despite 20-degree temperatures. With the economy improving, merchants hope the buying spree will last. The National Retail Federation predicts a 5.7% improvement from last year. Traditionally, Thanksgiving weekend has been the busiest, but nowadays, more people appear to be procrastinating. The biggest shopping week by far is the one right before Christmas. Last year, merchants raked in 41% of holiday sales that week. Thanksgiving weekend accounted for only 10%. Kathleen Schalk, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush is back in Texas following a surprise trip to Iraq yesterday. He had dinner with about 600 American troops, thanking them for the work they're doing in Iraq. And he assured Iraq's governing council that the U.S. will stay the course in their country. Former First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton visited Baghdad today. A soldier from the 101st Airborne Division has died after a mortar shell attack in Mosul in northern Iraq. Officials say 4 mortar shells hit a military compound in the city. An Iraqi worker was injured in the attack. Northern Ireland is holding legislative elections today. Returns show hardliners defeating moderates. That could deal a blow to hopes for reviving the joint Catholic-Protestant administration, which is at the heart of the 1998 peace accord for Northern Ireland. In Kenya, new allegations have surfaced about a plot to attack the new U.S. embassy in Nairobi. The old embassy was destroyed by a bomb in 1998. NPR's Jason Bobian reports from Kampala in neighboring Uganda.
3 men have been charged with conspiring to attack the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi in June. Prosecutors say they plan to use a car bomb and a small aircraft to blow up the heavily fortified compound. The building was constructed on the outskirts of town to replace the U.S. Embassy destroyed in 1998 during almost simultaneous attacks on the American missions in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. The 3 suspects accused of the new plot were already in custody in connection with the Paradise Hotel bombing in Mombasa last November. All 3 pleaded not guilty to the charges. The U.S. Embassy in Nairobi shut down for several days in June, at the time the men were allegedly planning to carry out the attack. British Airways also canceled all flights to the Kenyan capital, but has since resumed service. Jason Bobian, NPR News, Kampala.
With an hour of trading left today, the Dow is up 18 points to 97.98, the Nasdaq's up 7 to 19.60, the S&P is up a point. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, an insurance industry report finds that mid-size SUVs didn't do well in 5-mile-per-hour bumper crash tests. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
9 mid-size SUVs were rated by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. None received the highest rating. The 2003 Honda Pilot did earn the second highest. Damage in each of 4 bumper crash tests on the Pilot totaled $404. Sustaining the most damage was the 2003 Kia Sorento. It averaged more than $1,600 in damage per crash. The 2003 Toyota 4Runner and Infiniti FX35 and 2004 Chrysler Pacifica and Cadillac SRX sustained more than $1,200 in damage per test. They, along with the Sorento, received the Institute's lowest rating. The auto industry has been critical of the low-speed bumper tests, saying they are no gauge of vehicle safety. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks are trading slightly higher today in an abbreviated market session. Some economists believe the bull market will continue for a while. Chuck Carlson of Horizon Investment Services says Fed policies have a lot to do with that.
All the language coming out of the Fed over the last several months has been that we are going to be here to keep interest rates down. So I think the Fed will continue to do whatever it can to accommodate this bull market.
Investors will have some major economic news to consider next week. On Monday, they'll get a look at November auto sales, the latest manufacturing report, and new numbers on construction spending. Reports on productivity and factory orders come out later in the week. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders, books, music, movies, and the imagination behind them. At Borders, it's the original thought that counts. Location information at BordersStores.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Well, police in Italy and Germany have arrested three men suspected of being al-Qaeda operatives trying to recruit suicide bombers. Warrants are still out for the arrest of a man and a woman alleged to be part of the same cell. In England, police arrested another man, also said to be an al-Qaeda member. A small amount of explosives was found. Joining us from London is Mark Huban, security correspondent for the Financial Times. Welcome, Mark.
Hello.
Mark, thanks for joining us. Let's begin with the arrest in England in the town of Gloucester. Tell us about the man who was arrested, what was found, what he's being charged with.
Well, he's a 24-year-old man of Asian descent who, in fact, grew up in Malawi in southern Africa. Mm. He was arrested yesterday, in fact, and a small amount of explosives was found in the house in which he lived. And, in fact, police have been searching another house today with, obviously, the intent of trying to find whether there were any other devices or any other kinds of explosives or material that he may well have been planning to use in some sort of attack. The arrest was the result of, in fact, a very extensive period of observation of this particular man. Although he is someone who is thought to have perhaps been linked to Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, who was arrested after trying to blow up a bomb that was hidden inside his shoes on a plane that, in fact, stopped in Boston just after the September 11 attacks. The picture with regard to this man's intentions, the one who was arrested yesterday, the picture with regard to his intentions, the picture with regard to his connections, however, does remain pretty uncertain.
British press reports, however, that he was planning to blow up a stadium.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to the security people who have been obviously deeply involved in this whole issue, and there's been a lot of speculation as to what his possible targets may be. That one, and also possibly that he may have been planning to attack members of the royal family, they've both been dismissed as allegations at the moment, in the sense that the man himself has obviously not said anything with regard to what he was planning on doing, and there's no evidence to suggest, independent evidence to suggest that his targets were anything like as specific as a stadium or any leading figures in public life.
Hmm. Well, let's turn to those arrests in Germany and Italy. What can you tell us about them?
Well, this is a very, I think, a very interesting development. One of the people arrested in Germany was somebody who was arrested actually earlier in the year and then freed because of lack of evidence. He's someone who is thought by Italian police and also by German police to have possibly been involved in trying to recruit people from Europe to go and fight in Iraq against the forces there, of which there are clearly a large number of Italians who were attacked very recently and leading to several deaths. It seems that there's a possibility of a sort of network of recruitment individuals involved in recruiting who may also be connected to a man called Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is the essentially the head of a group called Al-Tawid. And Al-Tawid is an interesting organization. It has a sort of connection with Al-Qaeda, and Zarqawi himself has had connections with Al-Qaeda in the past. But most Americans will remember him as somebody who was identified by Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, as proof of a link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, or the former regime of Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Zarqawi was somebody who had received medical treatment in Baghdad and was seen as a sign of a connection between the Saddam Hussein regime and Al-Qaeda. And the fact that Zarqawi's name has come up again is, I think, very interesting and shows him to be an important player in the situation that is evolving as a result of what is taking place in Iraq.
Mark Cuban follows security issues in Europe and beyond as security correspondent for the Financial Times. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
The face looms up on a city street, usually a homeless man or woman, a lost soul looking for a handout. Sometimes the person's not quite sober, sometimes good-natured, and sometimes not so. For many of us, that's still our image of the homeless. But our next guest says the homeless, by the millions, are not who millions of us with roofs over our heads think they are. I'm joined now by Melinda Marble of Framingham, Massachusetts, a specialist in homeless issues, as executive director of the Paul and Phyllis Fireman Charitable Foundation. Welcome, Melinda.
Thank you, Bill.
So much publicity about the homeless over the years, a kind of compassion fatigue can even set in, especially when many of us still do associate the homeless with, frankly, derelicts.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that wrong-headed, Melinda?
Well, for one thing, in Massachusetts today, we have more than 20,000 children without permanent homes, Bill. We estimate that there are about 10,000 families in the state now who don't have a permanent address. And so for me, the typical face of homelessness is a woman with children who has faced the end of a marriage or been burned out of an apartment or simply isn't earning enough money to afford housing in the Boston area.
What is the situation nationally?
Nationally, between 5% and 10% of our American families find themselves homeless each year.
Hmm.
Isn't that just a staggering number?
That sounds like about 20 million people.
That's about right. We're the only industrialized country in the world that has this kind of rate of family homelessness.
Why is it?
It has a lot to do with the fact that entry-level wages have stagnated in our society for quite some years, and with the high cost of housing.
Give me an example that you encountered yourself personally.
Well, sure. Our organization, the One Family Campaign, runs a scholarship program for recently homeless women. And a couple of the women in that program, I'll give you two examples. One is Jessica, who's a woman who grew up in Belmont in a very affluent community, was in a house growing up where there was domestic violence and sort of saw that as a way of life. Married a man who began to batter her, had a child, and then realized, I can't live this way for my child, and left.
Mm.
And found herself, had never worked, had not finished college, could only get the most entry-level jobs, could not afford to get into an apartment, and so lived for more than a year in shelter, working, raising her son. Eventually got a scholarship through my organization and has gone on to get her bachelor's degree, and now I'm happy to say she's in an apartment.
Hmm.
So that's one face. Another is Susie, who is another one of our scholars, an immigrant, whose marriage and a successful family business fell apart when she was living outside of this country, who came to the U.S. She was a U.S. citizen with her six children, immediately went to work, got two jobs, but it was a year before she could save the money for a security deposit to get into an apartment. And I'll tell you, the day that we helped her and her six children move into a new place was a happy day. And every one of those kids has had a perfect school record since arriving in this country.
Is this mm-hmm. a problem that will ever go away?
Well, it's important to remember that until the early 80s, we didn't have this problem in this country. In 1982, we had, for example, in Massachusetts, two state-funded shelters for families. And when families got burned out of an apartment or simply ran out of money, they went into shelter, they stayed a few months, and then they were moved out to housing. And I think we can get to that place again. Today we have 80 state-funded shelters, and they're full every night. Every bed is full. And it costs the state $37,000 a year for each one of those beds. There has to be a better way, and I think we can end this and bring our families home.
Melinda Marble, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Melinda Marble has just been named one of Women's Day magazine's Women Who Inspire Us. She's executive director of the Paul and Phyllis Fireman Charitable Foundation. For more information, please check out our website at here-now.org. How healthy is the state you're in? Meaning not you personally, possibly still a tad more rotund than usual from yesterday's feast, but literally the state you're in. A new report's been done based on smoking and poverty rates and car accidents and a host of other factors. Of which of the 50 states are the healthiest to live in? Dr. Reed Tuckson of the United Health Foundation has established the new ranking.
If you're going to achieve or understand what health is, it really is a combination of multiple factors. Things that we do personally in terms of our behavior, the choices we make, the chances we take, whether we smoke and use seatbelts, and what our nutritional status is, whether or not we've graduated from high school. What are the occupational fatality rates? What is the level of uninsurance? What is the incidence of certain key diseases? What is the violence rate in that community? Is there access to care for people generally? Is there adequate prenatal care for pregnant women? And is there support for the public health infrastructure? Putting all that together, we think, gives us a pretty good composite picture of health and healthiness.
Doctor, would you indulge us and just give us the top 10 and the lowest 10 on the list?
The top 10 states were Minnesota, New Hampshire, Minnesota and New Hampshire, which were tied, Utah, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa, Maine, Colorado, and then Hawaii at number 10. And the states that were at the bottom of the list would be at number 41 would be Georgia, then Florida, Alabama, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Arkansas, South Carolina, Louisiana, and then at number 50 would be Mississippi.
How long have you been doing these surveys, these studies?
We've been doing this report since 1990, and since 1990, we've seen almost a 17% increase in overall healthiness for the nation as a whole, with a 1.4% increase since last year. So making progress, but the numbers underneath that story are that we're leveling off in our risk factor reduction, which means we don't think that we're going to see the progress in years to come unless we all take this challenge as a call to action.
So is this at all an urban versus rural breakdown? Not necessarily.
I think it's probably not so much urban versus rural as much as it is whether or not a state is involved in the comprehensive things that need to be done ultimately. And that really is meaning the states that do well in almost all of the categories across the board.
Doctor, a complex set of measures which you articulately put out, but can you break it down? Are there one or two or three factors that are most significant as to whether a state is healthy or unhealthy?
We are very worried about the rate of obesity in this country. It is growing at an alarming rate and one that demands attention. Secondly, we are concerned about the increase in the number of people who are uninsured. And thirdly, we are concerned that the overall risk factors that we were seeing decline, things like smoking and seatbelt and violent crime, and children in poverty, access to prenatal care, all of those measures I have leveled off in the last couple of years, and they're flat now. And if that persists, that means we won't see the kinds of successes in disease reduction and premature death avoided that we were seeing in years past.
Finally, Doctor, is the federal government doing enough to help states, in your opinion, particularly, of course, the states on the lower end of this?
I would say that when ultimate result is premature death and preventable misery and suffering, we all have more to do. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be acting as individuals, acting as members of community organizations, civic associations, fraternities, and sororities. But I think it's all of us working together.
Dr. Reed Tuckson of the United Health Foundation joined us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you.
Just ahead, visa programs that bring in foreign workers to the United States. Do they take jobs away from Americans or keep America competitive? And later in the show, Irish filmmaker Jim Sheridan about making his new film in America. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. For some months now, we've been addressing the issue of unemployment from several vantage points, putting particular emphasis on jobs going overseas, particularly high-tech jobs. There's no aspect of unemployment more painful and more infuriating for those who've lost their jobs than highly skilled U.S. workers being replaced by workers who cost less in places like India. Often, American workers say, foreigners are brought here on L-1 and H-1B visas, trained in how an American company works, and then sent back home to take an American's job. But this use of the visas for so-called outsourcing has benefits for the larger U.S. economy, says George Lester, an attorney with Foley Hoag in Boston and a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Welcome, George.
Thank you, Bill.
First off, George, so much controversy about these visas. You know a lot about them. Explain to us the two guest worker programs based on H-1B and L-1 visas.
The H-1B is a program for temporary work for professionals to come to the United States in what are called specialty occupations. That is a job that requires at least a bachelor's degree in a specialty subject, such as being a doctor, lawyer, engineer.
Or high-tech worker?
Yes, any kind of technology worker.
Sure.
Would qualify. Also, it's important in that category to understand that the U.S. employers are required to pay a prevailing wage, the same as a U.S. worker would make when they hire that person. The L-1 is a category for intra-company transferees. When there's a company or an office in the U.S. that also does business overseas, and they have an employee overseas who has worked for them at least 1 year in most cases, sometimes 6 months, and then they can be transferred here in what's called the L1A category, which is for managers or executives, or L1B, which is specialized knowledge. The theory in bringing those workers in is that they are bringing knowledge that you could not hire a U.S. worker for because it's internal to the company.
But the problem is, many say, with 2.5 million some odd manufacturing jobs lost in the last couple of years, some of them are high-tech jobs. People are brought in on these visas. They learn how to do their job the way we do it in the United States. And then they go back somewhere else and they do the same job a lot cheaper and somebody loses their job here.
First of all, we don't think that immigration policy is to blame for the kind of global economic forces and technological innovations that have led to this, quote, outsourcing that businesses do. But what we think mainly that obscures the important fact that these visa programs create jobs by helping American companies be more competitive.
Be more competitive how?
Well, for example, an American company has to compete globally, has to sell its products globally. So on the H-1B side, for example, they're able to access the best and brightest around the world. If you want to compete globally, you need to be able to access the best minds globally. And people have come in on the H-1B program and made research innovations, developed new products, and so on. These are professional-level jobs that then make the company more competitive and create further jobs down the line.
But that sounds like a slap at the American worker. The American workers can't be at least as best and brightest as someone from somewhere else? People who are raising families, people who are paying mortgages?
Well, let me...
People who need these jobs?
Well, let me further explain. On the H-1B side, one of the main ways that the H-1B helped the American economy is that when the times were booming for the technology companies, there was a shortage of these workers, a gross shortage of technology workers. All kinds of studies show that the U.S. educational system wasn't producing enough engineering graduates and math and science graduates to meet the demand. So a lot of people were brought in.
Yeah, but that's history. And it's true, those visas did become more popular
right.
at that time. But now they're costing Americans their jobs, aren't
well,
they?
Well, no, but I brought a whole statistical report. It's gone way down. Mm-hmm. From the year 2001, fiscal year 2001 to 2002, the number of new H-1B cases for computer professionals went down 80%.
George, what about allegations that L1 workers in particular are being placed by third-party consulting companies that are making a business out of bringing
right.
people in, getting them trained, and then sending them back?
We've heard those stories, and I can just tell you that's an abuse of the L1 category. Existing law on the L1 category does not allow people to come in to go to a third-party work site like that and do the job that the U.S. worker could do because it doesn't meet the definition of specialized knowledge. They're just using generic computer skills. Maybe the person's really good at C++ programming. Well, you can find a U.S. worker who's good at C++ programming. And if that's the skill the person has been brought in for and placed at a third-party site, that's not appropriate for the L1 category. What it is it's a case where whoever's doing that was misrepresenting the nature of the job when they brought the people in, or the consulates who were looking at the visa applications didn't do their job.
George, you do seem to be suggesting, though, that there's no scenario of high-tech workers who make less money in other places like India taking jobs from Americans who are as smart and as good at what they do but who cost more.
Well, if you're talking about outsourcing, sure, we don't dispute that. Perhaps it's less expensive to use companies in India for a type of back office function or a lower level software development.
And some of those
project.
Companies bring people in here to be trained and then bring them back to India to replace an American worker with an Indian worker who makes
well,
less money.
Well, they're not bringing them in here for the training. They're bringing them in here perhaps because they're a project manager or something like that.
Well, they learn the ropes of the company, sure. I
to
understand.
Be the liaison. But frankly, if you didn't have the L1 category to allow that kind of liaison, then I think what you'd see is the U.S. company packing up and moving the whole operation overseas rather than just the back office or lower level functions. Now, there's an excellent piece from Robert Reich in November 2nd's Washington Post that talks about the outsourcing trend. And he says that long term, he's not worried about the prospects for high technology job growth in the United States because, sure, these lower level projects are being outsourced, but there's a limit to what they can do because of quality control and other pressures. So while the higher level research and development will stay in the United States, we are the world's leader in technology development, and we always will be. And our economy has always found a way to innovate and bounce back. Certainly manufacturing jobs have gone overseas because it costs less to manufacture a sneaker in China than it does in Massachusetts. But the Massachusetts economy bounced back. We have one of the strongest economies in the country based on education, medicine, high technology, and so on. And as the economy turns around in the next year and a half, we'll bounce back and there will be jobs. And Robert Reich believes that.
George Lester, thanks very much for joining us today.
Okay.
George Lester is an attorney in Boston. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, that top secret presidential trip to Iraq, our editorial roundtable on how some are grousing about it, others glorying in it.
This could have turned very sour, and he made it. So I guess you got to say it took some guts.
And Irish director Jim Sheridan on his deeply personal film, In America.
You know, I had this feeling that other people have badges and flowers in their lapels, and I have my heart on my sleeve.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Malls and shopping centers are bustling on this traditional start of the Christmas shopping season. Bargain hunters braved long lines before dawn as retailers ushered in the season with early bird specials. The Washington-based National Retail Federation projects total holiday sales to be up nearly 6% from last year. President Bush is back in Texas after a whirlwind secret visit to Iraq. He arrived back at his ranch in Crawford shortly before daybreak after being away for just over 24 hours. That included 11-hour flights to and from Baghdad and 2.5 hours on the ground visiting troops. Meanwhile, New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton and Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island arrived in Baghdad today. The former First Lady and Reed, both Democrats, spent Thanksgiving touring war-ravaged Afghanistan and meeting with U.S. troops and Afghan officials. At least two U.S. soldiers were killed within hours of President Bush's visit in separate attacks in central and northern Iraq. More than 60 U.S. troops have been killed in hostile action there this month. Northern Ireland's power sharing between Catholics and Protestants is in doubt as hardliners beat moderates in legislative elections. The returns deal a blow to hopes of reviving the joint Catholic-Protestant administration at the heart of the British province's 1998 peace accord. Ian Paisley's Democratic Unionists appear to be winning the most seats in the 108-seat Northern Ireland Assembly. Sinn Féin, the Irish Republican Army-linked party, is likely to become the largest Catholic-backed group. Some bumper crash tests on midsize SUVs have shown disappointing results. Sagar Magani reports.
They're not as rough and ready as automakers want you to think.
In fact, most SUVs can't take a minor bump in a supermarket parking lot.
The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety crashed the SUVs at low speeds.
What we found is that 8 of the 9 new midsize SUVs sustained major damage.
Spokesman Russ Rader says many automakers seem to judge bumpers more for how they look than for how they deflect a common crash.
This is a low-speed test at basically a fast walking speed, and most of these SUVs sustained unacceptable damage.
Ranging anywhere from $400 to $2,800, the Honda Pilot was the only one getting an acceptable rating. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
On Wall Street at midday, stocks are higher, the Dow is up, the NASDAQ is up.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. You may be doing some postmortems on your Thanksgiving Day about now. Uncle Fred fell asleep on the couch again. Wasn't it great to see Cousin Margaret after all these years? And a lot of people, too, today discussing an unexpected guest in Baghdad. That was George W. Bush, of course, who flew for 13 hours to speak to some 600 soldiers, mostly from the 101st Airborne.
The president spent 10 minutes dishing out mashed potatoes and a little more time dishing out encouragement. He was on the ground in Iraq for about 2.5 hours in all. But was it a noble gesture for the president to sacrifice time with his own family for the sake of men and women far from theirs? Or was there just a whiff of politics about it all, or a bit of both? Well, to chew on this and other matters, we're joined now by two members of our editorial roundtable. Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Bill.
And Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hello, Bill.
Guy, this meant an awful lot to the troops. There's no question about that. They sent up a resounding and astonished roar when the president appeared from behind a curtain. But from your perspective as a newspaper guy, the White House lied to much of the press about this visit to Baghdad. They took along just a couple of print journalists, a Fox television team. That angered the New York Times Washington bureau chief Philip Taubman so much he said it's a bad precedent. People are perfectly capable, he said, of maintaining confidence for security reasons. Do you buy that?
I don't know whether I buy it or not. I think there's a lot of skeptical things that could be said about this trip, but I'm not inclined really to say many of them, simply because it was such a good gesture, both politically and I think substantially as well. When I saw this on television, I thought, my heavens, that is amazing. And I think that's the reaction that everybody had across the country was, wow, look at that. That clever guy, look what he did. You know, and how do you complain about that the next day, maybe in a week?
Randy?
When press secretaries, however, say things that aren't true, I think you do damage somewhat the trust between the White House and the press corps. And, you know, we may kind of grouse about it here in Flagstaff, but I think when you're closer to the ground, it does have the tendency to break that trust.
But, Randy, does anyone really believe that if the entire White House press corps had been informed about this, it wouldn't have leaked?
Well, I think the point is that the press secretary should not have tried to misdirect the press corps, and if you don't have something to say that's truthful, perhaps you just shouldn't say it.
You know, I think the question is, how important was this trip, both to the country and to the president? I remember, I must say, back 40 years ago when John Kennedy got a cold and had to leave the campaign trail in Chicago to go back to the White House, and his press secretary said that he had a sore throat. Well, what he was doing was he was planning the Cuban Missile Crisis, and afterwards, few people complained. You know, they said he had to do this. He can't very well say, I'm going back and I'm going to do this, that, and the other thing, and I'll tell you about it tomorrow. Sometimes a certain amount of stealth is important.
This falls more in the context, I guess, of a wartime gesture, and so it's always political somewhat to have that coverage of support for the troops. I do think that President Bush is trying to make up for the criticism he's taken by not attending the funerals of some of the more recently killed soldiers from Iraq.
Well, Randy, some tough talk from former Clinton White House spokesman Joe Lockhart. He said the president used the troops as a prop.
But again, I think that's what wartime visits are, and I think on the other side, as Guy noted, it has a real positive effect on the troops and on their kind of morale that they need.
Guy, was it a political masterstroke, as one editor of the National Review said?
Well, it looks like it this morning, although I thought the aircraft carrier speech was a political masterstroke, and that's turned out to be a complete disaster. So we'll have to find out what comes out on this one. But for now, yeah, it looks pretty good. It looks courageous. This could have turned very sour, and he made it. So I guess you got to say it took some guts.
Is there a danger any time the president calls attention to this situation in Iraq, where 180 soldiers have died since Bush himself declared an end to major conflict on May 1st? It's a delicate walk, isn't it?
It is a delicate walk. It's his war. He started it for reasons that turned out not to be entirely accurate. And now he's over there cheering everybody on. But it had that emotional wallop that it was intended to have, I think.
Let's turn our attention now, Guy, to that huge piece of legislation that passed this week. People have had a chance to digest it a little bit, the Medicare reform bill, of course, I'm talking about. What's the sense of it up in New Hampshire at this point?
Well, I don't know that we've all digested it yet. I took a look at the criticism from the left and the right and determined that they're probably both right. The left, the Democrats, were saying that this bill is not substantial enough, there aren't enough benefits in it. On the right, you had people like our Senator Judd Gregg from New Hampshire saying that it's so expensive that it's going to break the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you break the bank with modest benefits, how better could we underscore the fact that we're in trouble here in our medical system because we can't afford it?
So this was not a big winner among seniors in your neck of the woods.
No, I don't believe it was. I think people who are going to benefit from it are in a minority, and I think there are going to be people among the Medicare recipients who pay more now because of this.
Randy Wilson, a lot of seniors out in Arizona.
We actually probably are more supportive of it than back east.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here in the Mountain West, the smaller cities don't have access to some of the HMO Medicare plans, and there's really been a pent-up demand for low-cost drugs, and you see a lot of folks driving across the border to Mexico to buy them. So that's the primary piece here that we're interested in, is getting some kind of discounts on those prescription drugs.
Well, I'll tell you that the benefits we of course, drive up to Canada, and they took a provision in the bill. They took it out of the bill that would have allowed that. It's still illegal to bring in prescription drugs from Canada. But the benefits may turn out to be less than the seniors both in New Hampshire and in Arizona expect.
Randy, let's just finish up with a quick discussion of the big bill that didn't pass last week, the $30 billion energy bill. Any sense of that out in Arizona?
Well, at least here in the Mountain West, the tribes don't like it. A lot of the folks think it's too much of a subsidy for the oil and gas industries, not enough for solar. There's just too many kind of Christmas tree ornaments for a bill that seems to cost a lot and not really offer too much. So not much support here.
Guy?
Well, our state government sued the oil companies here about 6 weeks ago over a chemical called MTBE
right.
That is poisoning our water supply. This bill had a provision in it that would have made that suit, that lawsuit, moot because it would have protected the oil companies from lawsuits. So, needless to say, we're rather pleased that it hasn't passed.
Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Thanks a whole lot, Guy.
Thank you, Bill.
And Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona, where Randy Wilson told me it was 15 degrees at the crack of dawn this morning. Thanks a lot, Randy.
Thanks, Bill. It makes the shopping a little tougher.
Thanks to you both. Still to come, filmmakers Jim Sheridan about making a film sort of about yourself in America. You're listening to Here and Now. Ever found yourself suddenly out $300 or more because of a season ski pass you bought but then weren't able to use? Well, next time your winter unexpectedly goes downhill for one reason or another, there's a way to save your hard-earned cash: ski insurance. Joining me on the line is Ron Iverson. He's president of Skier Insurance Services, and he joins us from Kalispell, Montana. Welcome, Ron.
Hello, Bill.
Well, Ron, thanks for joining us. Yours is the only insurance company in the country, as far as I know, doing this sort of thing. What does ski insurance cover?
It covers three things. The first benefit is loss of use coverage, and this protects a skier's investment in a season pass. They can be downhill, cross-country. They can also be ski boarders or riders.
Hmm.
It responds to unexpected injury or illness. So now, if the pass holder is not able to ski for at least 30 consecutive days during the ski season, then we will reimburse the remaining value of the season pass on a pro rata basis. The other two benefits are, in effect, while skiing at the resort which issues the season pass. One of them is emergency evacuation insurance, up to $15,000. And the third and final benefit is accidental death dismemberment insurance, up to $10,000. Again, that's in effect while the pass holder is skiing at the resort which issues the pass.
Hmm. So what's it cost?
It is 6% of the season pass price. So a season pass which costs the consumer $500 It would cost them another $30 to insure that.
Hmm. Now, Ron, you're marketing this online on your website, but also it's being marketed through ski resorts. Now, what's in it for a ski resort?
One is it makes life easier for ski area personnel because when the pass holder makes a request for a refund, the season pass department can refer those consumers directly to us, and we'll deal with the pass holder. In addition, there's a financial incentive because we will pay 10% of the insurance cost to the participating ski area.
Hmm.
They put a link on their website, so it's convenient for consumers to find out about us since they'll be typically shopping online at the ski resort site anyway.
Now, Ron, you've been in insurance, I understand, for some 27 years, so I guess you know your business, but an awful lot of skiers, you know, get hurt or someone falls sick. Are you sure you can make money on this?
Absolutely.
Okay.
The incidence of loss among skiers really is not that great.
Uh-huh.
I should point out now that we do not cover extreme skiing, for example, heliskiing, free skiing, backcountry skiing. Those things are not considered normal skiing or snowboarding, so we do not cover them. And, of course, then we reduce the incidence of loss as well.
Well, an idea whose time may have come, ski insurance. Thanks a lot, Ron.
You're welcome.
And that was heliskiing. Ron Iverson is president of Skier Insurance Services. He spoke to us from Kalispell, Montana. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. The new film from Irish director and writer Jim Sheridan is called In America. Sheridan wrote and directed the Oscar-winning film My Left Foot. His other movies include In the Name of the Father and The Field. In America is by far his most personal film. It's about an Irish couple and their two young daughters who come to New York, just as Jim Sheridan did many years ago when he dreamed of being an actor and had to sort out mysteries like Halloween.
Everybody else goes trick-or-treating.
What's that?
It's what they do here for Halloween.
What do you mean, like help the Halloween party?
No, not help the Halloween party. You don't ask for help in America, you demand it. Trick or treat, you don't ask, you threaten.
You can't do that in our street.
Why not?
Because you can't threaten drug addicts and transvestites, that's why.
A scene from Jim Sheridan's In America, a film about America and family, and love, and death. In America, director and co-writer Jim Sheridan joins me in the studio. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
Many of your previous films, My Left Foot, which is about Irish poet Christy Brown, In the Name of the Father, which deals with the Irish Troubles, have been so connected to Ireland. Why In America?
Well, I learned, basically, I think, how to make films in America. I went to New York University and I came here in 81 and stayed for 8 years. And one of the people that lived in the house said to me, when I met them, they said, you should make a film about that house. That house was blessed.
This is the place where you first lived.
This is where I lived in New York.
There's a scene in which Samantha Morton and Patty Considine have a very emotional conversation, but they can't really argue because the kids are sleeping in the apartment.
Do you want me to lie?
You're the only actor in the world who can't lie, Johnny. Not even for the sake of your kids.
What does that mean?
If you can't touch somebody you created, how can you create somebody that'll touch anybody?
What are you going on about?
Acting, Johnny. And bringing something to life. It's the same thing. That's why you can't get a job acting, Johnny, because you can't feel anything.
How close is this to what Jim Sheridan was going through when you were a young guy with big dreams in New York?
That line was originally my wife's line, and it's not what comes out in the film. What happened was I was really in poverty because the theatre is not a great payer, as you know. And I decided to write screenplays to kind of try and get out of it. And I was sitting there writing my left foot, and my wife came in and stood beside me, and Fran said, you know, feel the baby, it's kicking. So I put my hand in her stomach and couldn't feel anything. The baby had stopped, and then she went away, and she came back about 10 minutes later and said, try again, and I did it again. The baby stopped again. I couldn't feel it. And she went away, and I went out, and she was crying, and I said, what's wrong? And what she actually said to me was, if you can't touch something you created, how can you create anything that will touch anybody?
Huh. You're dealing with grief in this movie as well. Why?
Because it was actually my brother who died, and he was 10 and I was 17.
The couple in the movie have lost their own child.
Yeah. Well, my dad, you know, I asked my dad what it was like to lose. I said, you know, it was difficult losing a sibling, but what was it like to lose a child? And he said to me, I had to create cells against tragedy. Hmm. You know, and it stuck with me. And I kind of had written the story, anecdotes, and there was no story. So I had no thematic unity. So it was only when I put in the story of my brother as my son and made myself my father that I got a distance from myself. See, when you write yourself as a character, you tend to write yourself one-dimensionally because you don't see any contradictions in what you do. You know, so characters in drama are made up of conflicted emotions. They're usually two or three people meshed together into one. You know, so it's only when I got it mixed up with my father and I could kind of laugh at myself or be annoyed at my father that I got a tone to the character. And that tone is brought through the daughter, who is in a way has my attitudes. So it's a very strange film, and it's very strong for a lot of people because they find it very emotional.
Yeah, because it does both tell a story and convey this enormous weight of emotion.
You know, I had this feeling that other people have badges and flowers in their lapels, and I have my heart on my sleeve. Now, luckily for me, you know, everybody on this film feels it as very real.
Key to this movie are those two amazing little girls who we heard in the cut about Halloween earlier in our conversation, Sarah and Emma Bolger.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find them? Because it must have been so hard to find two child actresses who could pull something like this off.
Well, I have to tell you the most extraordinary thing. You'd think it was, you know, mind-bogglingly difficult. You know, because when I wrote the script, I wrote for, you know, my daughter who was 5 when she came, and my other daughter was 9. But I didn't think a 9 or a 10-year-old could carry the older part. So I'd made her older. I'd made her 13 so she could attack the parents, you know. And I went into the audition and I looked around and I saw this angelic little face which reminded me of my daughter. And I said to her, would you read that? I don't know why I thought she could read. She was only 6. But she was perfect. She read it so perfectly that I went, wow, there's nothing left for me to do. So then I thought, no, it won't work. She'll be precocious and too confident. And so I said, is there anybody else? And my daughter said, that girl over there. So I went over to the other kid and asked her to read it. And as she was reading it, my jacket was yanked from behind. And I turned around and Emma was looking at me. as if I'd crossed an invisible line of etiquette. And she was looking at me very sophisticated, like with pity. And she just said to me with a quizzical expression, she said, "Jim." And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Is she reading my part?" And I looked at her and I thought of saying, "Well, it's an audition and you're the first to be auditioned." And then I said, I couldn't think of what to say to break her belief. So I stared at her to intimidate her, as you would, you know.
Yeah.
And nothing happened. She just stared back.
Yeah.
And she kept that look for 20, 30 seconds. And I had to say, "No, nobody's reading your part, your cast." And she was the first audition, first child, and she'd done one line. And then she said, "My sister's downstairs." And I said, "What age is she?" And she said, 10. And I said, "Too young." And she said, "Well, why don't you see her anyway?" So I went down and cast her sister.
Dad!
What?
What are you doing?
I'm reading my script.
Why?
I'm learning my lines.
Dad, America's okay.
Great.
Dad!
What?
Nothing!
I can't even express how good they are, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, they really are amazing.
Even if, you know, for some mad reason somebody didn't like the film, they're going to love the kids because there's nothing been ever like it. And, you know, it's maybe Drew Barrymore in E.T., you know, that kind of thing.
I agree with you. Having seen the film, I've never seen a film where the children were so real and unaffected and very much carry the movie to a great extent.
Yeah.
Jim, when you're making a film like this that's so personal and so emotional, are you so wrapped up in the making of the film that you keep a cool head throughout it? Or would, from time to time, something in the movie that was authentic, that had happened in your life, or that was reflecting for you the death that hovers over this film, the loss of your brother, would it kind of hit you in a way?
I could say to everybody, yeah, it was very cathartic and I could lie and whatever, but it's almost like the opposite. The film, like, I was cold making it. And I was very detached. And I think one of the reasons that it's not mawkish in that sense is that I'm not going through the experience the audience are.
Yeah.
When my brother died, although I lost faith, at the time, what I got back was a protective aura, I think, that when I walk on a set, the actors know I'm not going to let them die. And that's, I don't have to bring anything else to the party.
In America, in the great Jim Sheridan tradition of great films like My Left Foot and In the Name of the Father, his latest, In America. Jim Sheridan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for a great interview. Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Join me next time for the news and these stories here and now. We mark World AIDS Day, and Chile's former dictator calls himself an angel as chilling new information emerges about the actual brutality of General Pinochet's regime. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.